you know, as infants, there's no difference. If anything, boys are kind of more emotionally expressive, male infants, but we project onto them very quickly. So when there's a classic study that shows babies being startled by a jack-in-the-box in a video, a baby being startled. And if adults were told in advance that the baby being startled was male, whether or not that was true, they had diapers on, they would think that were more likely to think the baby's response to the jack-in-the-box was anger as opposed to fear. Yeah, or surprise.
Yeah.
Welcome to Shame Booth. This is our podcast. I'm Paula Williams.
And similarly, mothers talk with more emotional range and more emotional language to their infant daughters than they do to their infant sons. So from the get-go, boys are in a more impoverished emotional landscape. And mothers, too, when they talk to boys, to their infant boys about use emotional language, they overuse anger in comparison to other emotions and in comparison to their daughters. So there's a focus on taking all those emotions, you know, around sadness, grief, betrayal, heartbreak. I mean, anything that falls into that bucket, confusion, surprise, anything goes to anger. It all funnels into that one emotion. So, you know, one boy actually said to me, I think what guys are allowed is happiness and anger. And that's all
that's
you got.
That's it. That's Peggy Jo Orenstein, an author whose name you've likely heard because her books have been on the New York Times bestselling list. And City Arts and Lectures. She's done some TED Talks. She's kind of a bigwig. Anyway, she's written some books because she's a writer. Writers write books. Here they are. Check it out. Schoolgirls, Young Women, Self-Esteem, and the Confidence Gap. Could have been helpful reading that. Dealing with the Bullying on the Playground. Flux, Women on Sex, Work, Kids, Love, and Life in a Half-Changed World. Waiting for Daisy, a book about her daughter. Cinderella Ate My Daughter, Girls and Sex, Don't Call Me Princess, Essays on Girls, Women, Sex, and Life. She be busy, but she's getting a lot of press right now with her new book, Boys and Sex, Young Men on Hookups, Love, Porn, Consent, and Navigating the New Masculinity, which was just released and is shaking it up, yo, around the conceptions or really the misconceptions we have around boys, sex, porn, intimacy, and how much these boys really want to talk about it, which was one of the biggest surprises I think she found. These boys actually carry a lot of shame. Shame for what they do engage in, shame for what they don't, shame for what is expected of them, shame when they don't rise to the seeming expectation. Sex and shame can sometimes seem inextricable. You know, it's just, it's complicated. It's got a lot of parts and we've got to tease it out, you know, and that's what we do here at Shame Booth. We're really untangling all of this shame, getting to a place of feeling proud. Oh, hell yes. In this interview with Peggy, I'm on a first name basis with her, Peggy Jo, we spoke about boys and girls and sex and porn, and how Peggy's parents left sex ed books laying around the house. No wonder she got interested, and she has remained so for almost 30 years. We had a great combo. Check it out.
I'm talking with Peggy Orenstein, and it's my birthday.
Happy birthday!
And it's a great way to celebrate my birthday, is talking to another amazing woman who is shaking things up in a very big way with a lot of her incredible writing and ideas about girls and boys and gender and sex and body issues and how we're the patriarchy, all that stuff. But welcome.
Thank you.
I know this is going to be a really fun conversation. What I want to do is ask you first, how does a Jewish girl from Minneapolis
named Peggy Jo?
Peggy Jo Orenstein?
Yeah, I know. My parents were momentarily hijacked by people from the South.
Peggy Jo.
I know. That's my name.
How does Peggy Jo Orenstein find her way to Oberlin College, finds herself married to a Japanese man,
ends up in American, yeah.
Japanese-American, mm-hmm. ends up in Berkeley, the mm-hmm. liberal bastion of, you know, the West, and then writes about sex and
I know.
How did this happen?
It was a lateral move. I don't know. You know, I was thinking about this the other day. I was thinking about how I grew up and the kind of messages I got growing up about sex and gender and my early experience with all of that, and then kind of the experience moving into Oberlin. I grew up in a fairly devout Jewish home and with pretty traditional parents. And my parents were very clear that sex before marriage was not it wasn't even a thing in my mind, to be honest. It was not something I even ever harbored an idea about until I was just about to go to college. And my dad had said to me, you know, why buy the cow when you can get the milk for free? He actually used that phrase, bless his heart. But my mom would also always tell me that sex should be really great, that women should enjoy sex, that her sex life with my dad was fantastic, which I really didn't want to know, but was grateful nonetheless in retrospect to know. She actually also, years later, when I was in my 30s probably, or my 40s maybe, came up to me. I was sitting on the couch in her apartment. She kind of nudged me in the ribs and said, doesn't stop after 70, you know.
Ugh.
I know. It was like, thank you. But I was really glad to know that, actually, in, you know, speaking to the larger idea of talk to your kids. And they also left a lot of books about sex around the house. Like everything you wanted to know about sex was always in the room where I studied for high school, which was really interesting. And I mean, I think if you went back on that book, it probably has a lot of, you know, problems. I would probably find it sexist now, I imagine. But at the time, like it had a whole chapter on female sexual response and orgasm and masturbation. And I was like reading that going, oh, very interesting. I better go try this.
And did you try it?
Yes. Absolutely.
Good for you.
And my parents never like said, what are you doing in the bathroom for 4 hours? Or, you know, whatever. Why are you taking a bath for the entire evening? You know, like, they were just like, you know, they were sex positive in a way, but also the context was a really big deal for them. And I guess the other piece of that in terms of how I ended up writing about these topics that I think was formative was when I was a senior in high school, I wanted to be a journalist from the time I was 14, and I took a journalism class in 10th grade, and it was like the scales fell from my eyes, and I thought, this is it. This is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And I never wavered. And so I was really into the school paper. And when I was a senior, my school counselor, she wanted me to interview a teenage mother in my high school. I went to a really large, you know, like my high school graduating class was like 700 kids
me
or something.
Me too. And there were pregnant teenagers,
yeah.
But they kept them in a secret room.
Right.
Yeah.
And you didn't
really
know about
weird
them.
Weird experience.
Yeah. And again, didn't know they were there.
Right.
And because of the way I grew up, I didn't even know people were having sex. Like it was like completely news to me. And so I was like, yeah, sure. So they had this girl and we met in a room in an empty classroom, and I interviewed her, and she had a 2-year-old. She was 18 and she had a 2-year-old. And she told me about her life, and she told me about how hard it was and how it was a secret that nobody knew at school that she had a child. And I was using an anonymous name and all that kind of stuff for her. And then she, you know, we had this very intense conversation, and then she got up. And she, as she was walking out of the room, she turned and said, if you see me in the hall, don't say hi to me, because there is no way somebody like you would know somebody like me. And I don't want anybody to be suspicious and start asking questions. And then she like disappeared into the mass of teens. Right. And I just sat there. I've never forgotten that. And I thought, you know, I don't think I was like analytical and aware enough to have this thought. But basically, it was a moment where I was on some level realizing that this was about not just a teenage mother and the perils of that, but it was about like these two girls on really different paths where class and circumstance really mediated how we got to be in the world and who we got to be in the world, and the ways that one person's story can really tell something universal about the time that we live in. And I think that that really lit a fire under me. And I never forgot. I mean, I don't know what else I did in high school. I don't know what other stories I wrote. But I will never forget that one.
So let's get into the book. So I read Girls and Sex, which came out 4 years ago.
Yeah, 2016.
Yeah, I had it on Audible.
And you were listening to me.
I was listening because you have a really good voice, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I love the way you write. You write in a way that's relatable and non-clinical. And so, and a lot of the anecdotal stories that you tell, I find very relatable. It almost makes me think, okay, if I need to have a conversation with my daughter, there's kind of a roadmap in these books to help
me
do
that.
Yeah. So good on you. So yeah, Girls in Sex, and I had it on Audible, and I would make sure that I'd be listening to it when I picked the girls up from school.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like,
that's what I always
say. The idea that when they're in the car, they can't get out.
Exactly. And they don't have to make eye contact.
No, and they look away, or they'll lean in and they're like, oh, mom, please. Or they'll say, we've already talked about this at school.
Yeah.
I'm like, I doubt it. They went to Catholic.
Yeah.
They went to Catholic school.
Yeah.
So I doubt it. But I love that you wrote this book. I found it really helpful. I almost wish that I knew this stuff when I was their age.
I know. I hear that a lot.
I would have avoided some pretty awful things.
Maybe. I wish that that was true. Sometimes I have,
I mean, it is what it is, but I kept thinking, gosh, I would have been able to get out of this situation, or I would have been able to, you know, say no to something, or to be able to see where this kind of manipulation and coercion was
going.
Yeah,
to get outside of the script and to see it for what it is. I know. I think that's super valuable. And one of the things that's been really kind of overwhelming, honestly, for me in touring around with Boys and Sex is having people who read Girls and Sex come out, like in droves, and talk to me about how much that book meant to them. Because, you know, I mean, the truth is, I spend most of my time sitting alone in a room. I'm not like, I mean, once in a while I go out and give talks or whatever, but I'm a writer. I'm a pretty solitary person up on my hill. And so to walk into a room and have hundreds of people who read something I wrote and had it and found meaning in it, it's just like, I can barely speak when I see that. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And why did you feel the need, and I know you've answered this probably many times, but I'd like to hear it again. Why did you write Boys and Sex? Like, who cares? You know, we focus so much on the girls and protecting the girls and teaching them, don't go to a party alone. Don't get too drunk. Don't, you know, it's like all these don'ts and be careful. And now it's like,
there's
boys.
A lot of don'ts with boys.
Yeah,
right?
So why boys?
Well, you know, I'd only had half a conversation, I realized. But when Girls and Sex came out, there was just like a real, like everywhere I went, when I was touring with the book, parents and girls and boys themselves would say, what about the boys? What about the boys? And my initial thought was, that's really somebody else's job, because I felt like, you know, first of all, I look like their mom. I wasn't sure they would talk to me. I was afraid if I tried to talk to boys, I'd have entire transcripts of, nope, you know. But also, it felt to me like it was girls whose lives, what I was chronicling in a lot of ways was the transformation of girls' lives by feminism and the contradictions they still faced because of half change. And I didn't feel, and it was girls' parents who were pushing for further change for their daughters. It wasn't so much protection, it was change. And I didn't see that in boys and boys' parents in the same way. But I also realized pretty quickly as I thought about it that I had spent already by that point like 5 years talking to kids about sex and being in kind of the trenches of adolescent social life. So I knew the terrain, and that nobody was really listening to boys in the way I had listened to girls and surfacing their voices around this. So I started doing some kind of preliminary interviews, and then the Me Too allegations kind of just rocked the world. And suddenly, you know, the level of misconduct across all sectors of society became so clear by men, you know, young and old. And the people that used to say to me when I would talk about my work with girls, like, you know, I'm kind of glad I have sons.
Yeah.
They weren't saying that anymore. Right. They suddenly knew that they had a harder job and they had to raise good men. And so I felt like there was suddenly people were looking, you know, masculinity was being declared toxic and broken and all these things. So everybody was suddenly thinking about what all this meant. And it seemed to me that it also created this opportunity to talk to boys and surface their voices and really engage them in conversations at this moment of transition around sex and intimacy and masculinity and gender dynamics in a really new way. So then it was a really exciting prospect for me, and that really got me ticking.
And you had people kind of lined up already, boys or even teachers or parents of boys, saying, we want you to talk to these boys.
Honestly, I felt like people were flinging boys at me. You know,
really?
Like they would come up to me because I would started talking about it pretty early on. I would be on, you know, the radio or on a podcast or giving a talk to parents. And I'd say, well, you know, I'm thinking about writing a book about boys now. And then afterwards, people would like flood me with email. You know, this is my son's text. This is my son's phone number. This is my son's email.
Would you talk to my son?
Talk to my son. Yeah, because I think they were hoping that I would not just interview, but actually educate. And then boys themselves. I had a number of boys who found my email after hearing me on the radio saying that I was thinking about talking about boys, or I had published some, you know, I spun off a few pieces early on. And they said, you know, I read that. I heard you. Would you interview me? I have something to say. So it was interesting to me how much hunger and how much eagerness there was among boys and among parents to have me talk to boys in a way. And this may speak to the protective piece, or it may speak to my being a more known quantity at that point. But it was hard to find girls. It was much harder to find girls, which seems counterintuitive.
It is, but they, now that I just think about it, they have their circle of girlfriends to talk to.
Yeah.
Boys don't.
Right.
Talk about intimate,
right,
vulnerable things with each other.
And that was what I hadn't reckoned on, you know, when I was thinking, oh, gosh, what if they don't talk? What I hadn't reckoned on was that nobody ever lets them talk. And so that given the opportunity and the permission and being allowed to, you know, somebody saying, I really want to know what you think about these issues, no judgment, just curiosity, they were more forthcoming than the girls. They were really eager to talk, and not all of them, obviously, but you know, so many of them were also surprisingly and incredibly insightful narrators of their own experience and had a lot of insight into it. They could also be unreliable narrators of their own experience, but they were really, you know, they were really interesting.
Did that surprise you?
Yes, it did. I mean, that was my big fear, was that I would, that they would not talk to me. And I think the other piece probably, you know, I mean, I think that in a weird way, it advantaged me to be a woman. That was my other big fear, was that, you know, I'm a woman who looks like their mother coming in to talk to them, or looks like somebody who could be their mother, to talk to them about their sex lives. Like, who's going to want to do that? But I think that if guys are going to drop, and I, you know, I talk a lot in the book about how guys learn emotional suppression and the wall they talked about building somewhere in middle school or early high school between their authentic selves and their feelings and what they were allowed to present to the world. If they're going to drop that, they're going to drop it in front of a woman. And so for anything that maybe they didn't tell me because I was female, and they're pretty raw and blunt, so I don't think there was a lot, but for anything they might not have told me, there was, I think, something that they actually did tell me for that very reason.
Mm-hmm. Did they have a lot of shame around the inability to open up to their friends or to kind of get in touch? The shame, I mean, you know, guys don't want to show you their soft spots. So what did you see as kind of those walls were coming down, like a relief?
Yeah.
That they'd been holding up.
Yeah. I mean, they would often say that the interviews were cathartic or they were therapeutic. I mean, that's the most common thing, was it felt like therapy. And I get that. And that is the other model for having a middle-aged woman sitting in front of you with a notepad. But it wasn't my job for it to be therapy. You know, that I had to be really clear about that. I wasn't there to give them advice or, you know, to necessarily help them work something through, except so far as they worked it through for me to understand their thinking for my work. But I think nonetheless, just bearing witness was therapeutic for a lot of boys. And yeah, I think that boys carry a lot of defensiveness and shame around talking about feelings, but around a lot of these masculinity issues, and that is part of what polices them and keeps them from sometimes speaking out in situations where they ought to stand up and speak out and have that courage.
Mm-hmm. You said in the book, too, that, you know, boys and girls typically start off around the same time expressing themselves and the freedom to do that. But around, is it middle kindergarten?
Well, that's what, yeah, that was in one piece of research by Judy Chu. Yeah, that, you know, as infants, there's no difference. If anything, boys are kind of more emotionally expressive, male infants, but we project onto them very quickly. So when there's a classic study that shows babies being startled by a jack-in-the-box in a video, a baby being startled. And if adults were told in advance that the baby being startled was male, whether or not that was true, they had diapers on, they would think that were more likely to think the baby's response to the jack-in-the-box was anger as opposed to
fear.
Yeah, or surprise.
Yeah.
And similarly, mothers talk with more emotional range and more emotional language to their infant daughters than they do to their infant sons. So from the get-go, boys are in a more impoverished emotional landscape. And mothers, too, when they talk to boys, to their infant boys about use emotional language, they overuse anger in comparison to other emotions and in comparison to their daughters. So there's a focus on taking all those emotions, you know, around sadness, grief, betrayal, heartbreak. I mean, anything that falls into that bucket, confusion, surprise, anything goes to anger. It all funnels into that one emotion. So, you know, one boy actually said to me, I think what guys are allowed is happiness and anger. And that's all you got.
That's it.
So that was, you know, was really interesting.
You know, what's interesting, too, is I always had this idea that the reason boys became aggressors or the inability to express emotion or joy was related to the relationship they had with the father.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I had that idea, but it's so interesting to know, like, a lot of it comes
mothers
from the relationship
yeah.
with the mother.
But
yeah.
also, I mean, it is also true. The reason I say that about mothers is that fathers use less emotional language with their babies, regardless of gender.
Yeah.
Though they, again, are more likely to recognize sadness in girls than in boys. So it's also true in research that boys will say that the source of restrictive gender roles about restrictive ideas about masculinity are their parents and the main source. And they will cite their fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And in talking about that with guys, there were guys who would say, my dad would say, man up or don't be a little bitch or, you know, that kind of thing, definitely. But there were many, many guys who would also say, my dad was not sexist. My dad was not homophobic. I did not learn that toxic, you know, so-called toxic masculinity from him. But I did learn the emotionally stunted side of masculinity because he was more of a sigh and walk away kind of guy
yeah.
than the kind of guy who would ask you what was going on and talk about your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And that message was equally loud and clear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If there's something difficult or uncomfortable, I'm not going to push it. I'm just going to walk away. And
yep.
yeah, I think I know some guys like that.
Yeah. And yeah. that's not it's a benign thing. But and it's subtler, but it had a really strong impact on boys. And I felt like at the heart of boys and sex, I mean, like at the heart of girls and sex is this idea of girls being disconnected from their bodies and disconnected from their wants and their needs and even their limits. And at the hearts of boys and sex, it's not even about sex in a weird way. It's about boys and vulnerability and
not connected to their hearts
and the ways that they are, you know, wrestling with that taboo, the shame of vulnerability, the taboo about vulnerability, the, you know, denying it, embracing it, capitulating to it, and the ways that that not only harms them, because Brené Brown says vulnerability is the secret sauce to holding mm-hmm. a relationship together, right?
Yeah.
So it harms them, but it also then radiates outward and in multiple ways can harm their romantic partners.
Do you know if this is, I know there's a bunch of studies and conversation around the Dutch. I love the Dutch.
I know.
Kind of have this thing like, what would the Dutch do? I mean, they're so ahead of, I was in Amsterdam over the summer and I just love their approach to almost
everything. I know.
And how they have sleepovers.
I know.
At a young age and they know their kids are having sex or intimate.
Yeah.
And they allow it. Tell me what you found in that.
Well, so that was fascinating because when as Americans, we tend to there's a book called Not Under My Roof by Amy Shallett, who's a professor at University of Massachusetts, and she compared American and Dutch attitudes towards teens and sex, and not under my roof. The idea of that is, you know, that's what American parents say. But it means that our kids grow up by lying to us, essentially, right? Like, we know they're off doing this stuff, whether it's sex or substances or whatever, but we pretend they're not. We don't talk about it with them. We just say don't. And then they're off doing whatever they're doing, possibly quite dangerously so.
Yeah.
And then they come home and they pretend to be somebody else. And what the Dutch have this concept called, I can't pronounce it because I don't, their language is really hard, but it's like gezelligkeit, something like that.
Gezelligkeit. God bless you.
Yeah, exactly. And it means cozy togetherness anyway. And it's about growing up in an interdependent way in a family. So you are, of course, and I actually last night I did a reading and there was a Dutch person in the audience who just like, went, I said this and she just went off on it. She's like, I do not understand the Americans and how they, why would you want your child to be off having sex in a car or in a park or, you know, doing, I mean, it's so unsafe. Why would you not be discussing it with them and making sure that they were home in a bed? Yeah. It's like, I know. The Dutch used that interdependence and also the idea of the sleepover to negotiate as a kind of soft control. And it allows them to negotiate the terms, to reinforce their values, to make sure that kids are protected from disease and pregnancy, to make sure that they're with a partner that the parent approves of and is caring and trust, you know, trustworthy. And they have so much better outcomes than we do. There was a study that compared early sexual experiences of 400 Dutch girls and American girls at demographically similar universities and found that right down the line, the Dutch had like lower rates of pregnancy and disease. The girls were less likely to be drunk in their first experience. They were more likely to know their partner and say they could communicate. They were more likely to enjoy the experience. All these other things, at least in the positive sense, they're, you know, when they chose to be in an experience, it was a much more positive, less regret, you know, certainly. And when they looked more closely, they found that Dutch parents, teachers, and doctors all talk to kids from a super early age about sex, pleasure, and the importance of a loving, trusting relationship. And it wasn't necessarily that Americans were less willing to talk about sex, but we frame all our conversations in terms of risk and danger. And the Dutch talk about responsibility and joy. So in all those ways, and in, you know, allowing for kids to explore their sexuality and talk about that within the family and making sure that that's something that's normalized and then allowed to, you know, to transmit positive values about what you want to your child, just the whole way they talk about it, they have better outcomes. And meanwhile, we are in this culture where our kids are steeped in commodified sexualized imagery, much of which reinforces shame or, mm-hmm. or plays from shame, and then simultaneously complete silence from the adults in their lives about what constitutes a positive sexual experience, what constitutes a mutually gratifying, personally fulfilling relationship, whether that is going to be for 5 minutes or 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Share a little bit about the impact of porn. and I love how you said, too, in an interview was, if you think that this is like your 70s porn,
you've got to go look at Pornhub.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm an advertisement for Pornhub. I'm like, I'm telling everybody to go on their site. Wait a second.
Subscriptions are going to go up. But no, it's and I've heard too that the impact that it's causing on males, you know, erection and performance, because I'm so used to seeing these horribly graphic stuff. But anyway, talk about the porn
and girls too, because girls also look at porn not as much as boys, but they do, and they look at it as a manual for what guys want. You know, I mean, obviously, curiosity about sex is normal. Obviously, masturbation, yay. And you can debate ideas about whether it's possible to have feminist porn or queer porn or ethical porn, all that kind of stuff. But that's kind of beside the point because that's all behind the paywall. Pornhub dropped the paywall in 2007. So you used to have to pay to get hardcore porn. They couldn't see it. They might be able to get, like, you know, some shots of naked women or something, but they couldn't see anything that you can imagine and many things you would never imagine for free. So everything's free and accessible and anonymous now. That's what's different. You don't have to go into a video store. You don't have to pay for anything. It's just there. Whatever you can And that's why I say parents need to go and look at Pornhub, especially mothers, because they're the least likely to have seen it. There's some research from Indiana that showed that of parent-child dyad, same-sex parent-child dyads, so fathers and sons, mothers and daughters, that showed that the kids, the teenagers, it was 14 to 18-year-olds, watched much more porn than their parents and much harder core porn. So the boys were more three times more likely than their dads to have seen gangbangs, rape porn, facial abuse, double penetration, all that stuff. And with the girls, the differential between them and their mothers was actually even bigger. So again, it's the, you know, you need to, if you've got that 70s porn idea, you're wrong.
So wrong.
And what the and what boys would say to me was, well, I know the difference between fantasy and reality.
Mm.
But that's not how media works.
Especially when you're 12, 13, 14
right.
and seeing
like,
that
like, what
stuff.
Does that mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's their shut you down line. But it's not true. Because for one thing, media, the whole point of media is that it affects your thoughts, beliefs, and actions, even when you think it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And what one guy said to me that really stuck with me ultimately more than anything in the porn discussion, and I think it's a really important chapter in that book, in Boys and Sex, because it really does lay so much of it out, I think, in a hopefully non-judgmental way that boys can understand and just think about. Not necessarily because they'll never look at it again, but just think about the impact and think about what else they could do. But one boy said to me, I just feel like the whole ability to go into your sexual relationships and explore sex without any preconceived notions of what it is, like that natural organic process, has just been fucked for our generation by porn.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you just like that statement, just there's so much in
that. That makes me so sad.
I know. It made me sad. I just thought, wow. And this was a kid who was like super, like really into hookups. He was while he was talking, there was some girl sending him like, you know, come hither shots and
really?
Let's go hook up. And like, he was not a guy who was super sensitive.
Yeah. Yeah.
About, you know, or super feminist or super egalitarian. He wasn't at all.
Mm-hmm.
And he still felt that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Two porn things in the book. One was a kid was like trying to go to CNN. He wanted to.
All right. He was like, I'm just trying to go to CNN. Like, and I find myself inadvertently almost thinking, maybe I'll just cover to the porn site. But, you know, we all know how that feels, right? You're trying to do your work or you're trying to go Google something and you think, I'm just going to like tiptoe over
is
to Facebook
boredom?
For a second.
Is it boredom?
No, I think it's.
A hit? A dopamine hit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's the attention economy and the ways that, you know, it's compulsive.
Yeah.
I mean, the internet just fosters every possible. And then you're a boy on top of it, and you're like thinking about sex all the time anyway, and you're thinking about, you know, you're like masturbating all the time anyway, and that's fine. That's good.
Yeah.
But this is just like such an, it's like junk food.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that I thought a lot about with porn and talking to boys is like, what is the difference between something that is super arousing versus something that you desire, that's pleasurable, that you want?
It used to be, porn used to be like the pizza guy coming to deliver a pizza.
I know, with the dick in the box.
Yeah.
I know. And there's so much like, also like any sexual content, and it's particularly now, you know, in today's era, sexualized content is so commodified and so constant and constantly reinforces these ideas of male sexual entitlement and female sexual availability. That's not just porn. That's TV. That's social media. That's video games. That's songs. That's music videos. And guys would say things like, you know, one guy said to me, I think, you know, yeah, music has a big influence on how guys treat girls. You're driving around with your guys all day in the car and you're hearing fuck that bitch and leave her mm-hmm. 2, 4, 6, 10 times. You think that's not going to affect your mindset? Of course it affects your mindset. I think as parents, as teachers, as advocates, as activists, as therapists, we over the last 20 plus years have worked so hard to provide that for girls. You know, we have recognized, everybody knows, even across political spectra, everybody knows the messages girls get from the media about their bodies, about sex, about women are harmful. And we work to arm them at the very least to hopefully resist some of that and hopefully be less affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do that with boys.
Mm-mm.
Not at all. We're not talking to boys from the time they're young about, you know, why are there no girls in your media. Why are there no female protagonists? Hey, let's look at your toys. Let's look at your books. We're not talking about them when they're older. Who's in your video games? We're not talking to them about what's going on in your lyrics, in your music videos. And again, they'll just say, well, I don't listen to the lyrics. Not true.
It gets in there.
Media affects you even when you think it doesn't. That is what it does. That is its job. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like understanding some of the mechanisms, again, it's like not just, you know, saying don't do this or something, but it's like, let's try to understand some of the mechanisms that you might not be seeing that socialize you into certain beliefs and ideas, even when you think that's not happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's making that visible. That was a really core concept in Boys and Sex.
Yeah. We have a lot of work to do, but I love that you wrote this book. And
thank you.
The one
it's exciting. It's very much about, you know, the desire that guys had. And that's why it was interesting to do this book right now, because I feel like we're in an inflection point around this, where the guys were struggling with things and we were discussing things that I honestly think 5-6 years ago, they wouldn't even known to question. And just the movement in that regard was really exciting to see.
Okay. We didn't cover this, but I think this will be a great way to go out is
okay.
How to talk to your fucking teenagers, even though it's uncomfortable and there's eye rolling and you're embarrassed is it has to start here. We can't keep putting this, you know, on teachers or on, let's call up Peggy and have her, you know, do a curriculum for our kids. But so just there. And
also
then,
you can use the cool aunt or the cool uncle or the, you know, the best friend that shares you. It doesn't always have to be there. But
yes.
Anyway, after nearly a decade of reporting on teenagers and sex, if I know anything for sure, it's that parents just have to get over it. I know it's awkward. I know it's excruciating. I know it's unclear how to begin. You may have never even been able to have such conversations with your own spouse or partner. I get that. But this is your chance to do better. Discomfort and embarrassment are not excuses to opt out of parenting. Quick tip, talk during physical activity. Or even better, in the car. You don't need to look at each other. Plus, they can't escape. Despite their eye-rolling, ear-plugging, and other superficial resistance, teenagers consistently say that they do want such information from parents and that they benefit from it. I know from experience that's true. Boys often told me that our conversations had dramatic, ongoing, sometimes therapeutic impact, and I was a total stranger. So rather than fixating on how discussing physical and emotional intimacy makes you and your son want to sink into the earth, consider the opportunity it creates for a closer relationship, to show him that you are genuinely there for him, to display openness, strength, and perseverance in the face of messy realities. How, after all, will he be able to have those challenging conversations as an adult if you don't pave the way now?
Thank you so much for writing these books.
Thank you for having me.
I can't wait to see what's next.
Yeah, I don't know.
50-year-old women and
maybe.
Sex.
Maybe.
Good.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you and congratulations
too.
Okay, Peggy Jo. So, oh, man, she was so cool and brave and smart. And I actually have been telling all my friends who have boys, whether they're already, you know, in college or teenagers, or even if they're 5, 6, 7 years old, is like, if you've got a son, you need to read this book. And if you've got a daughter, you need to read Girls and Sex. And you should probably actually read both just so you can understand where boys are coming from and where girls are coming from. Okay, so along with all of her many accolades, this book is getting one that keeps coming up is just read this book so you can talk to your kids about sex. My first time was not good. And I know other people that have had amazing experiences, and I think that kind of sets the tone for the type of relationships you have, the choices you make, how you feel about your body, and just being comfortable, being intimate, you know? It's a beautiful thing, and I think we need to take this idea of shame out of it so that we can have these beautiful connections. We wanted to speak with Peggy because we do have a lot of clips from the booth where boys or men are sharing their shame around their experiences with identity and around sex. And we need to hear more of these voices. Here are a few we selected.
What would it be like if I had absolutely no secrets? I don't know. That would be hard. But the thing that actually I thought I was going to use that as a prompt, but actually I'm just going to talk about what I'm feeling shame about right now. And it's about texting this girl. It's sort of stupid, but it's like, I added her on Facebook cause she was super cute. And then I found out we had 22 friends in common, and I just keep texting her and she doesn't respond back to me, but she like sort of responds back to me. But, yeah, I'm embarrassed. I feel ashamed about pursuing someone and showing my interest. I feel ashamed for my interest in her. And I feel ashamed that it appears to be unrequited. Yeah. And I, in general, just for all of the unrequited love that I felt and how I've perceived it as a rejection and how that rejection shames the fuck out of me. Ugh. Oh man, I'm like in my 30s now and I've been just getting rejected. Since kindergarten, I've been shamed for being interested in women. I had this genital share with a kindergarten lady friend of mine. It was just like an under the table, like I'll show you mine if you show me yours kind of thing, and we got in trouble. And I don't know. I think that should be healthy. I think probably the shame in that situation was not mine and not hers, not meant to be mine or hers, but it was the teacher's, and it should have stopped with the teacher. And just adjacent to shame is like fucking anger. Anger at the injustice of shame. Anger around the way that it propagates and gets foisted on us as kids and teenagers and adults, and like this never fucking ending dump of shame from wherever, from within, from others, from society, from history, from karma, wherever you want to attribute the cause, it pisses me off. And I right now commit to reclaiming my show and tell kindergarten experience. And I also commit to dropping the shame around texting that girl or messaging her or whatever. It's okay to be interested in somebody, and it's not like I'm not being creepy or anything. I'm just letting her know that I'm genuinely interested and available for whatever shows up on the map. So, and I don't need to feel any particular way, no matter how she responds. I certainly don't need to create shame as a response. Okay. I think that's enough. I'm hungry.
All right, so my boyfriend told me the other day, oh, you don't look like a person that's dated around too much or was a hoochie or whatever. But in my head, I was like, I dated, but I didn't tell him, like, yeah, I've dated around. Like, who cares? And I guess that's my shame, because I didn't necessarily confess to that and say, hey, no, I did date around and that's okay. Why can men date around? But when a woman dates around, you know, she's a hoe. Or he didn't say anything like that, but I just thought about it. Like, what if I did tell him I dated other men and, you know, I dated for a few years before I met him? So I guess I'm leaving my shame on dating and being a woman that, you know, knows what she likes or knows what she doesn't like. And that's it. Thanks.
So I'm dating my girlfriend, Olivia, and we've been dating for almost 5 months now, and I'm going off to college. And, you know, I told her, like, I want to have sex with other people, and I feel ashamed about that because I just don't want to, like, ruin our relationship just because of some urges that I have. But also, like, if I stayed with her, I'd always have those urges because I've never been with anyone else, and I just want to get them out of the way so that I can focus on us. But you know, those are just urges that I have, and I guess I'm just ashamed of those, and I feel like it's so stupid that they almost got in the way of our relationship, but I think it can work out. Thank you.
Okay, I know I say this every time, but this is a really big deal for people who have the courage to step inside the booth or call on the shame line to leave some shame behind and feel lighter and more proud. So we thank you for that.
As you know, the booth, well, maybe you don't know, maybe you're new to Shame Booth, so welcome if you're new. And we just wanted to tell you that the booth does travel. We have three different booths now, and we've got some big ass plans for 2020. So hopefully the booth will be coming to a town near you. And as you know, there are phones everywhere. You've probably got one in your pocket, and you don't need to get to the booth to shed your shame. You can actually call the Shame Line, 888-SHAME-LINE. Call anytime. Oh, it was so good to talk to Peggy, and we thank you for that, Peggy Jo. My name is Paula Williams, and this is Shame Booth, a podcast series about getting what?
Proud.
Oh, I feel proud. So if you want to learn more, not about me, but just about Shame Booth, go to shamebooth.org. Shame Booth, the podcast, is produced by Sound Made Public with Tanya Katinjan, who is here holding the mic. Holding the mic. And Philip Wood and Katie McCutcheon, who is killing it with our Instagram. Shame Booth, the team, is me, Paula Williams, and Retta Rowland, and all of our shame dames who represent in the red jumpsuits at events all over the country. We thank you. It's 2020. It's 2020. And we just got our vision on. Yes. And guess what? We want more ears on this podcast and eyes on everything that we create, from our Instagram, which I'm having a winding of a time, especially in the stories that I'm putting up there, and at all the events we will be at this year, and our podcast. Tell your friends, find us on Instagrams, and help us get people proud. This is a big year, and I think people are feeling a lot of feelings. And we really started this project to help people feel a little bit better and a little lighter and a little freer. So we want to get the word out in every way. So share, rate, share again, for crying out loud. And if you have any ideas about collaboration, we would love to hear from you. So reach out. Oh, and again, would you just talk to your boys about sex? This whole Me Too movement and this new wave of feminism is really giving us a chance. It's an opportunity to do things differently, to do it better, to raise better men. If we teach our young people to not hide behind shame around sex, to own what they truly want, and to own who they truly are, things will change. Because at the root of all of us, boy, girl, non-binary, is really a genuine desire to love and to be loved. And shame don't need to get in the way. So talk, share, and get this book. Thanks, everyone. Next month's episode, Debbie Millman. Stay tuned. Welcome, welcome, welcome. John Oliver does that every week. I love it. I have to pee a lot, and oftentimes I do, you know, I have accidents.
Yeah, it happens.
It's
my grandma's accident.
Kind of a bummer. I'm 54. What are you going to do? I squeezed three babies out of my pootie hole. So, you know, and I don't do my kegels. I'm paying the price. Anyway, you know, they're doing it. I don't know. Newsflash. Like, your kids are fucking. I did need a plunger downstairs for the Hopa cropper.
No, did you?
I did. For good. Why are you laughing?
The Peggy Jo. Peggy
it's
Jo
her
Orenstein.
Name. Her parents named her Peggy Jo Orenstein. I love
good.
It.
It's too good.
Peggy Jo.
Peggy Jo, come here.
Oi, Peggy Jo, get in here for God's sakes. Where the fuck am I? Okay. We can't say.